Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Alchemy podcast. I'm Travis Dow.
And I'm Pete Coleman from the Bohemican podcast.
All right, so every once in a while we talk about two alchemists or kind of a duo in one show. And, you know, like Edward Kelly, John Dee, or Tycho Brahe and Johannes Kepler. Now, today we're going to do that, but really just because they vaguely lived in the same place in the same time. Okay.
Other than that, not a whole lot connected.
Yeah, the only thing they have in common is that Pete has trouble pronouncing their names.
Which is going to be evident here shortly.
In fact, what are their names, Pete?
Agoth Damon. I've been practicing all day.
Yeah, you know what? Okay, I don't know either. I think we'll
Zosimos
go with
of Panopolis.
Yeah, that one people might have heard of.
Okay.
I think we'll go with Agatha Damon.
Agatha, yeah? Damon and Zosimos of Panopolis.
So proud right now.
I've been working at this for hours.
I know.
I was going to let you down.
I heard you muttering at your desk, and I came back.
People are like, he's gone crazy.
He's talking about demons.
He's speaking in tongues. But yes, those are the two guys we're talking about today. Because you're right that the threads that bind them together are very, very thin, other than the chronological aspect that they were alive at the same time.
Yeah, and this is an important part of history. We just did an episode on Neoplatonism. So we're talking about around 300 AD in Roman Egypt. Okay, one's from Alexandria, one's from southern Egypt, but basically Alexandria was the center of alchemy at that time, in a very different sense possibly. So to start us off with Agatho Damon, so we no longer have any direct works from Agatho Damon. We just have kind of medieval fragments of his work, and he was described by medieval alchemists or by medieval thinkers, and it basically just describes elements and minerals. Okay, but one thing that has come down to us is that he has a way to produce silver, which is all that's needed to qualify him for this podcast, and he also describes poisons. He calls it a fiery poison, possibly arsenic trioxide, possibly amphoteric oxide.
That's right, Travis, that the poison would be dissolved in the water. It would stay clear. And if you dunked some copper into it, it turned a deep green, which arsenic trioxide would typically do. So his methods could be considered the basis of future poison experiments, with the air quotes, if I can say that. But they were often used for murder.
Yeah.
Right. So something that would be used if you remember arsenic and old lace, the old Broadway deal. That you slip that into someone's beverage or into some food, and they would die shortly.
Yeah.
But it would be a very tough death. You would be regurgitating and vomiting. It would be a rough way to go. That was his
reputation in the medieval days, that he was kind of the father of poison or something. I mean, he had a reputation.
Let's look through history for
warranted
a minute. You know, during the time of the Roman Empire, after the Republic was set up, and when it went into Roman Empire, the emperors, most of them were poisoned, if not stabbed in the back by their own guards. But a lot of them were poisoned. That was kind of the method of operation for disposing of a despot
he was kind of in the right place at the right time.
So I would say yes. I was like, wow, there's a new poison. Fantastic. Thanks. Mm-hmm. Right? So these are things to think about. Historical texts that are related to him have a lot to do with just mentioning his name. All right? You wouldn't even know that he existed if it wasn't for this.
Right.
Alchemy was in decline at this time, but Nestorian Christians fled to Persia around the year 400. This, in one way, led to some later knowledge that got to the Arabs just a little bit after the conquest of Alexandria, and possibly directly contributed to the rise of alchemy in the Middle East. Now, that's a pretty big statement, because we're talking about alchemy was a really big part of this in the Middle East. So they're saying that at this point, the Godfather was
Yeah.
Was this guy?
Well, I think this is fascinating because, I never, before reading about this, I never really read about the Nestorian Christian aspect of it. Like obviously the conquest of Alexandria, I always assumed that, when the Arabs conquered Egypt, that then these Greek writings kind of went to them that way. But it wasn't the only way. It turns out that even before the Islamic invasion, that there was already some trickles of these things before Islam, even, were making its way to Persia and kind of,
Well, we could probably think the trade routes too. I mean, that brought a lot of information as well. We talked about the Greek influence on Arab influence at this time. But it also flowed back to medieval Europeans, especially after the fall of Constantinople and the reconquest of Spain.
Yeah.
Right. So it's very interesting to take a look at how some of this knowledge base got from the Persians, even before the Arabs arrived, like you mentioned. Yeah. So we're going to stop right there with Agathodaemon, mostly because that's all we know about him for sure. He's mentioned here and there throughout history, but it's hard to get a real grasp on the real man and his work. So we're just going to move on from him at this point.
Well, yeah, let me add, if any of our listeners know more, please shoot me an email with a source or something, because he sounds kind of interesting. If you send me something, I will read it, absolutely. It's just hard to – some of these guys, there's only a couple of fragments. There's only, a snippet here and there. And I feel like, of course, a lot of alchemists are just lost to history. We'll never know. But it's just, we got this name. We know a couple of things he did. And I'm sure that some historian at some point has written something about him. But so if any listener happens to – this happens to be a known figure to him, her – then let us know. I'll read it. So I'll be greatly, greatly thankful.
So we're going to jump right now from a person that might be lost to history to someone we know a little bit about, Travis, and that would be Zosimos of Panopolis.
Yeah, he was, again, Egyptian or Greek alchemist, and also a Gnostic mystic, again, from around 300 AD. Now, you could make the argument that he's the first real alchemist writer that we can go to today. So that let me clarify that a little bit. So he mentions older alchemists, okay? So he mentions older alchemists in his writings, but his writings are the oldest ones that we have,
Now, were they on papyrus, or what were the writings on?
Oh, I would assume.
Something that would last a long time.
I would assume papyrus, but that has just been then transcribed to Arabic, or, translated to Arabic, and then, whereas Agathodaemon.
So this most likely was Greek.
Probably Greek, yeah.
Okay.
But I would say that Agathodaemon is just gone. So, people might have quoted him later, but we don't have anything. Yeah, I'm not sure if we have any extant copies of Zosimos of Panopolis, but we know what he said. We know what he wrote. All right. So as his name might suggest, he was born in Panopolis, present-day Achmim in the south of Egypt. I'm sorry. I'm sure I butchered that. I apologize. But I think it's Achmim present day. And he wrote the oldest known books on alchemy. Yeah, I think it was Greek as far as I know. But then it was translated into Syriac and Arabic. And sometimes he's written as Thosimos, Dosimos, or just Rimos. It's pretty normal for people's name to change. I mean, we had like Al-Razi being turned to Razis and Al-Ghazali being turned to
different cultures
to
put different stamps on different names.
You remember
right?
We had Michael Sedzivoy. We kept saying that, but exactly. Everyone knew him as Michael Sendivogius.
His Latin terminology,
right?
Right.
So yeah, this is pretty normal. I think on one of your episodes you mentioned Jan Jasinski was Jan Jasenius, or even not even Jan, but some Latin version of John or something.
What about Wenceslaus versus Václav?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's a hard thing to, for saying Wenceslaus for most Western people. That's not how you say it here in Czech.
It's
Václav.
Yeah. But you did an episode on Adalbert. What's he in Czech?
Vojtěch.
Which is totally different.
Yeah, so I mean, every culture's got their different, spin with their language, and this is a good case of that right here.
Yeah, like what's Peter in Czech?
Petr. So it's not that bad. So we missed the point on that one, but you guys get the idea.
Okay, so again, so he has this. This is the time period where you have a lot of Hermeticism, a lot of Gnostic influence. Now this is interesting because he was a Gnostic mystic, according to the Book of Enoch and Apocryphon of John. The fallen angels taught the art of metallurgy to the woman they married. Okay? Now, if you say ancient aliens, I will punch you in the face.
I am not going to bring – I know that's a sore subject with you on ancient aliens that have given us knowledge.
Fallen angels.
Okay. Hold on. I got to put the stops on this for a second. I did not know that fallen angels could marry mortal women. Is this possible?
You should maybe as a good mass – going Catholic, you should maybe read your Bible a little bit more there.
Well, no.
Peter?
I've heard of ancient Greek gods like Zeus doing this type of thing. But a fallen angel? Really?
Without in front of me, I wouldn't want to. Do you want to get into this right now?
I really don't. But okay. We might have to edit this part out.
Their children, the angels and the mortal women and the angels' children were the giants.
Not a Christian belief system.
Yes, in the Bible. We're talking
Genesis.
So
you got me lost on this one.
So the external processes of metallic transmutation, like the transmutation of lead and copper into silver and gold, had to mirror an inner process of purification and redemption.
That's a religious spin to this.
Yeah, and if this sounds like Hermeticism or Gnosticism or Neoplatonism, that's because it is. So this has come up over and over and over. So, but he said it differently than some of the later guys. So he did write about metallurgy. He just said that if you wanted to do it, you needed to be kind of clean on the inside. The purer you are, the purer your metal will become. So there was a reflection, macrocosm, microcosm, the macrocosm, microcosm, that whole, one reflects the other. So he wrote about mirrors a lot. Okay. This was over and over. So the process is a reflection. Okay. Now, divine water or sulfurous water, which was used by Greek alchemists, there's a word that means both of those things in Greek. You could translate it either way. Now, Zosimus saw it like this. So the alchemical vessel, he saw that as like the baptismal font. And the tincturing vapors of mercury and sulfur were purifying waters of baptism. Now, I think vapors of mercury are not that purifying, but hey. But if you're talking about metal, fine. Now, this perfected and redeemed the Gnostic initiate. So just think of it like a baptism. And then also the hermetic image of the crater or mixing bowl, a symbol of the divine mind in which the hermetic initiate was baptized and purified in the course of a visionary ascent through the heavens and the transcendent realms.
And when we talk about the transcendent realms, this is, when we talk about a mirror as well, this is a perfect reflection of maybe the very earliest parts of the Christian belief system and their rituals. Because we're talking, 300 AD? So we're talking about here?
Yeah.
So, at this point, you're talking about maybe St. Clement, if I'm not mistaken, but you're talking about the very early church and the Gnostics. And, of course, that was a schism there at one point between two different churches and thoughts. The idea of a baptismal bowl, the idea of burning incense, to purification. Yeah. I mean, those are things that are part of the ritual process from the very earliest parts of the church. So it's not a really far leap to see that Zosimus maybe acquired some of this knowledge from his Gnostic background and said, well, let's incorporate it into what I'm doing here with this very beginning of alchemy.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about the dreams?
Yeah, Travis, visions, maybe I should say this before we get into the visions. When you say visions, I'm thinking of early civilizations when people would use elements of peyote or other issues to have these visions. Is this what we're talking about here?
This sounds like that, but he mentioned them as dreams.
Okay.
So let's give him the benefit of the doubt.
Right, so he's not in a sweat lodge. Dehydrated. He's not on some kind of herbal elements,
but
or
when
alcohol.
You hear about this,
you're gonna think
so,
twice.
Yeah,
all right.
Go ahead. Give us the lowdown.
All right.
Here.
So Zosimus had some visions that were a little bit kooky. He had these dreams about alchemy, and the visions that came to him were very heavy on symbolism, and were very weird. Mm-hmm. Just put it that way. So Zosimus met Ion. Ion is mm-hmm. how we're going to say this. He was the founder of the Sabian religion. Ion fights Zosimus with a sword in this dream, and pails him, disembowels him, little Harry Carey action, pulls the skin off his head, burns mm-hmm. the pieces of this body on an altar so they're transmutated from the body to the spirit. And that's one way of doing this type of alchemy.
Sure.
All right? Now, it's not a fun way. We're not saying it's fun. All right? So I'm sure when he woke up from this dream, he wasn't going, wow, that was great. I'm really sad I woke up from that. It was probably more of like, whoa, I need to really digest this for a few minutes about what just happened to me in this dream. But the idea of that Ion cries blood and horribly melts into the opposite of himself, into a mutated Anthroparion,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, I think I had this dream, but I was on NyQuil, all right,
okay.
With a high fever. All right, so This is crazy stuff. You might have seen this in Indiana Jones. Do you remember that?
He cries blood and then melts. So I think if I watch Indiana Jones and then True Blood and then fall asleep, I might have a – no, I would never have a dream like this.
No, this is out there. Now to say this, this is one heck of an imagination to write this down, but – think about the dreams that you've had, folks. I mean, some of the dreams that we had are crazy. And, of course, as soon as you wake up, you think, I remember every aspect of this dream. And if you don't write it down right there, you will forget it. Mm-hmm. And it's because your body, your mental state can't really handle what you've just seen in a lot of ways. So you move on from it. Evidently, he probably was so moved by this dream that it was something that drew him to pen and paper to start writing this down.
Well, it keeps going. Well, okay, so the thing is that, yeah, exactly. He, at this point in the dream, when he cries blood, horribly melts, and then turns into, quote, the opposite of himself, okay? So he wakes up, he ponders this. So like you said, he mulls this over and says, wow.
Ponders very nice. Introspection. He's like, he had introspection.
Yeah,
Not screaming around the house. I would have been screaming.
Yeah, that was weird.
I need some.
But now, okay, so he goes back to sleep. It's not over. So he's back at the altar. Someone is being boiled alive, but he's alive. And the boiled guy says, just calm as a cucumber, the sight that you see is the entrance and the exit and the transformation. Those who seek to obtain the art or moral perfection enter here and become spirits by escaping from the body. Okay? Now, he wakes up again. So again, I'm summarizing this dream. It is much, much longer and kind of fun to read. So he wakes up and he ponders the meaning. He's thinking, okay, human distillation. This goes back to Neoplatonism, the transmutation of the soul, spiritual alchemy, that kind of thing. So human distillation, like water, to distill it into vapor, it's transmutating water to vapor. So in this case, transmutating the body to the soul or, something like that. Okay, goes back to sleep and dreams of a place of punishments where all who enter immediately burst into flames and submit themselves to an unendurable torment. Sounds like hell, right? Like, sounds like the classic
absolutely
Dante's kind of,
or anything from Revelations. I mean, at this point,
yeah,
I'm thinking this has some ideas of biblical connections, but whatever it is, definitely a moving experience.
Like we said, he pondered these things, right? So he gave this some thought, and he came up with what these things could mean. Now, he didn't consult Freud because Freud wasn't there. That might have been a good thing. I don't know.
Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
Yeah, well, again, right? Yeah. In this case, maybe not so much. Well, what this does remind me of are these, I've mentioned before, these weird alchemical illustrations. If I see someone being skewered or having the skin torn off his head, then alchemists will instantly think of some meaning. And Zosimos was a metallurgist. Like, he really did. He was into metallurgy, so he did kind of everything in his life he put into that context in some way. All right, so yeah, give us one of these examples.
Well, one of the examples that really stands out here is the symbolism of a snake eating itself, and that's the head eating, devouring its own tail in a circle. Mm-hmm. And what that really symbolizes here to Zosimos is the idea of unity of everything. So think back to our Neoplatonism podcast. There really is. There's really no. That's no coincidence that we're talking about this,
right?
Because
it's that time period.
It's something that I'm thinking about, and that's something that you probably would see maybe etched on a stone someplace.
Sure.
To talk about these thoughts, it would be the snake in a circle, kind of devouring itself. He does also mention some other issues in symbolism, and the number 7. He mentions that quite a bit. At one point, there's 15 stairs. There's 7 stairs up. The 8th is the sphere of fixed stars, the divine part of the cosmos, and the 7 stairs back down. Mm-hmm. All right, you with me numerically?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So 7 stairs being the planets, the sun, the moon. You got it. All right. So by now you know that if you're paying attention to this podcast, 7 is a really big deal. All right. Now, in the idea of early church, we talk about the triumvirate. We talk about 3s being a big deal.
Right.
7 is kind of a departure, isn't it? I mean,
for 7 is a big deal in a lot of different religions. But also, there's the four elements. There's the seven, what is, you know, basically sulfur, salt, and mercury. Mm-hmm. You add those up, what do you get? I mean, seven comes up all over the place.
Right.
So five, four, three, seven, all numbers mean something. In fact, we'll do a podcast on numerology because it is really important in alchemy and in certain aspects.
And there's also another Neoplatonic sort of idea too, dealing with mirrors, right?
Right.
So, you know, rather than to see a reflection of the material self, you contemplate the divine self with this reflection, right?
Yeah.
So he's more of a Gnostic sense of the Holy Spirit. Again, incorporation from his background, his religious background, into his thoughts here.
And yeah, this might be a good place to mention, because we just mentioned numerology. So it's also letters of the Greek alphabet had symbolic meaning. Now, not quite in the sense of numerology where there's like a number associated with it, but he really got deep into letters that had a meaning. So like an example, quote something from... This is Zosimos of Panopolis on the letter Omega. This is Jackson's translation. I forget his first name. Round Omega is the bipartite letter, the one that in terms of material language belongs to the seventh planetary zone, that of Kronos. For in terms of the immaterial, it is something else altogether, something inexplicable, which only Nikotheos the hidden knows. So it's like esoteric. In material terms, Omega is what he calls ocean, the birth, and seed of the gods. Okay? So to me, Omega is like, oh, and that's it.
That's it. Him, okay. Well, you know, yeah. Well, when we hear about the Omega particle in some science fiction literature, we hear about, you know, the end of all things.
Right. Omega, Alpha and Omega.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, so there is another connection on a religious basis with this as well. So, but it's not just the Christian Gnostic thought. There's a Jewish issue involved with this too, with the metallurgy here. Zosimos had a real fascination and an affinity for this concept of Jewish metallurgy. And furthermore, knowing this, many alchemists would write that he might have a very strong Jewish connection. That's really not been proven. But at the same time, Zosimos really had an affinity for this concept that kind of went beyond maybe other alchemists' connections to Jewish metallurgy. Julius Ruska proposed that Zosimos may have been Jewish altogether, but scholars, like we said probably not enough evidence for that to support that. But, you know, we get this information from Raphael Patai from his book, The Jewish Alchemists. That's something that you may want to look into to see the findings for that as well. But it is clear that he did have respect for Jewish metallurgy, the distillation, the mysticism, and how to try to show that it was in agreement with Egyptian thought. So it all does come together.
Yeah, I mean, he really liked kind of Jewish theology, philosophy, and all that thing. And so he tried to show that it was in sync with Egyptian thoughts at the time. So it's interesting. Okay, also, once again, we see that astrology plays a very important role in alchemy. Okay, we see this over and over again. One of these days, we're going to do a podcast on astrology and clarify that role more in depth. But in Zosimos' case, so he believed in natural versus unnatural alchemy. Natural alchemy doesn't necessarily mean the natural process of the way the mountain creates the gold, but that there is a good and a bad way to do alchemy. That's what he meant. So he had something called timely tinctures. So we talked about tinctures all the time, actually, like the elixir of life or, you know, something to that effect, some elixir. But he calls it timely tinctures because you do certain things at certain times in sync with the, you know, the moon phase or zodiac, you know, something to that effect. So if you do it at the wrong time, that would be unnatural alchemy. Again, if this sounds familiar, it is. But this also goes way back. So this isn't just him. The idea, in fact, when we mention astrology, we're talking about Greek astrology, but you could say Greek Babylonian astrology because that's where they kind of got it from. And for example, Mesopotamian glassmaking recipes dating from like 1300 to 1100 BCE contain instructions for the astrological timing of various procedures. So just, you know, plain old simple glass blowing or glassmaking. So, you know, this was considered relevant for a long time. And, I mean, if you want to speculate, the idea is even as simple as it is important when you plant your crops. Seasonally.
My grandfather,
so therefore, why wouldn't it be important to do everything else?
Absolutely. My grandfather, who learned this from his father and his father's father, came from northern Germany. to America. He always told me,
he had a saying or something?
He did. He said, you only plant potatoes by the light of a dark moon.
Okay.
And,
yeah.
and the other thing he did, he could witch a well. I mean, seriously, I remember as a kid.
With the divining rod,
and he would walk out and witch a well on his farm. And that's where he would dig for well water. Seen it work. It right in front of me. Wouldn't believe it. So the stuff that we kind of consider old world, you know, voodoo or superstitions, you know, dealing with agricultural issues, there's something to it, man. So, sure. I mean, you know, we talk about the moon and its effect on tides and the earth. Absolutely, there's some of these things to it. I won't go beyond that personally, but some people really put a lot of weight on this.
Yeah, absolutely. To dive into a little bit further into Zosimos' ideas of why this timely tincture is relevant. So he believed that demons only had knowledge of a very specific part of the cosmos, the parts in which they lived, okay? But the creator had knowledge of all of it, of the whole cosmos, everything in it, everything. So by timing your works so that it doesn't coincide with the demon parts of the cosmos, the work can be greater. Okay, so basically, you can do alchemy either way, natural, unnatural. But if you're not timing your astrological things right, then the demons have an influence. You might make gold, but you're call it black magic. You're using negative forces to create that gold. Okay, and I say create gold because this is an alchemical podcast. However, it probably he just meant like pure gold when you're smelting it. I'm not going to jump to conclusions here, but because of his metallurgy and you know, especially the mysticism, he also got a. Well, the thing I will say is that he did write about earlier alchemists a lot. So you know, like he's, I believe, I don't have all my sources in front of me right now, but he is the one that mentioned Mary the Jewess and possibly even Hermes Trismegistus. So we wouldn't even know about them at all if it wasn't for him. He's kind of our source for these third century alchemists. So third, fourth century is really when we start getting, you know, maybe not extant copies, but definitely first person accounts.
Yeah. You know, when I look at Zosimos here, he's a guy, a historical figure that I don't know if I can keep close to me in the sense that I can understand him. You know, it sounds like he really had a thought process. Normally, I would say that he probably was on acid. I mean, a lot of this stuff sounds like he had an acid trip.
Yeah.
What he did with these dreams and these ideas to make sense of them and his idea of reality must have influenced a lot of people, especially mystics, you know, maybe even a splinter section of mm-hmm. Gnostics, because he did have a religious overtone to some of these things. I would say that without him, we wouldn't have a lot of information. So he was key.
Yeah. Well, he was – yeah. I mean, we would have lost a lot more knowledge.
But key.
He was an odd one, but we would have lost a lot more knowledge about earlier alchemists if it wasn't for him. When you mentioned the influence of ideas, like definitely, you know, so he has this Neoplatonic concept of while you're smelting your metal, whatever it may be, that you contemplate nature. And we talked about like Neoplatonist meditation that it's not meditation in the Eastern sense. It's like you're contemplating God. Okay, that's like Neoplatonic meditation. So as you're smelting your metal, you're contemplating nature. This gives it a spiritual component, and this is really just your basic, you know, Neoplatonic, Hermetic, Gnostic concept of meditation. And by contemplating the divine, he believed you can get a better result of your work, of your smelting, or whatever it is you're doing. Yeah, that's basically it. I had a great source for this today. It was worldnewsresearch.com, and it was just / Zosimos. We'll get you there.
As we're wrapping up the show here tonight, I think that going forward with the Alchemy podcast, these little snippets and historical biographical sketches really paint a picture for me as I'm learning along with our audience, Travis, that there's so many of these leaders and thinkers and doers in the alchemy world that I never knew existed. And if you were to tell me this stuff, I'd probably say you're lying. So this bibliography is very important because this stuff's not made up. These people, at least to our best of our knowledge, these people were really alive. And they all had, if not something hugely done with alchemy as far as being a staple to the science, then they had some kind of influence on somebody else.
Yeah.
I find that very interesting that there's this almost passing of the torch as we see in these podcasts from, you know, Al-Ghazali to Roger Bacon to John Dee. It all connects.
We've mostly talked about early ones, but the thing is that these guys, these are the original Greek Egyptian ones. Now we talked about Al-Ghazali. We talked about Albertus Magnus, who already in the medieval times was getting some Arabic knowledge back into Europe. But then later, when we talk about early modern period, let's say 16th century, then now we're getting into more of a kind of scientific thinking, Renaissance, if you will. And I won't, but Renaissance, if you will. And the thing is that a lot of that influence was these Arabic thinkers, and a lot of that influence was these Greek thinkers. And so, as kooky as Zosimos' visions sound like, there was an influence. There was even if it was just spiritual, a lot of these people influenced later people that influenced later people that brought us science. I mean, that's a roundabout way to look at it. But and there's other ways to look at that. Absolutely.
Sure. I think
there's a lot
any
of critics.
Human knowledge base,
there will be critics to the way I just said that.
No, I understand what you're saying, because with any human knowledge base, there are fits and seizures of what is discovered and what is understood. And I think it all builds on itself to our knowledge base today. We are far from where we need to be in science, but boy, we've made some serious strides. And I think we get to thank some of these forefathers of this knowledge in some form or respects.
Yeah. Well, another thing I'll bring up, because I think we're slowly painting a picture of alchemy, right? And like as time goes on, I mean, many people, even now we've done like six episodes, seven, I don't remember. It's hard to say. In fact, by the time this one gets published, it'll be more like 10 or 12. But people that have listened now kind of at least can define what alchemy maybe is through the centuries. And it's interesting because I did a... actually for Reddit, I'm going to do something there for talk about alchemy, but I did a Venn diagram just to define what I read about. So if you go to historyofalchemy.com, on the homepage, I put that Venn diagram up, because if someone has no idea what to expect from this podcast, so there's a Venn diagram, in the middle there's alchemy, and then you see that there's Neoplatonism, there's astrology, there's theurgy, numerology, hermeticism, there's the spiritual alchemy, medical alchemy, practical alchemy, and then where does Philosopher's Stone fall in that Venn diagram? Where does the Elixir of Life fall into it? Where does Egyptian mummification? Where does early chemistry? Where do there's all these, like even just discovery of acids, it falls in there somewhere. I mean, it's all part of alchemy. So I think a picture can say 1,000 words. So go take a look at that if you're still confused about the big picture of this podcast. By all means, check us out at historyofalchemy.com. Yeah, for details on that, for details on Zosimos, and also on other past episodes and some glimpses of future episodes we'll be doing. Our email address is podcast@historyofalchemy.com. You can find us on Facebook under History of Alchemy Podcast, and on Twitter as Alchemy Podcast, whatever your preferred method is. Send us ideas, questions, corrections. Don't be too harsh, but corrections, pronunciations, whatever. We'd love to hear from you. And you do us a great favor by rating us on iTunes. So we're on iTunes. You can find us there, subscribe there. But if you rate us, you bump us up the charts a little bit. That really helps us out a lot.
And while you're hopping on iTunes, feel free to go to my website or go to my podcast, Bohemican Podcast, and see if you can rate us there, listen, subscribe, do all those wonderful things. But you can also go to the website, which is bohemican.com, and check out what I'm doing here in the Czech Republic and the experiences that I'm having as an American expat. I'm also on the Twitter. Do I sound – when I say the Twitter, does it make me sound like I'm 40? Because that's scary. But
sounds like Pete.
I am on the Twitter, so you can go to that, hashtag CrazyTown. Just kidding. I don't know what I'm talking about. But go to that. You can actually see a lot of things on the website, including my blog, about things I figure out as I'm living here. It is an amazing place, and I really enjoy my time here in Prague. We'll be back every 2 weeks, and we want to thank you very much for listening tonight.
Yep, thank you very much.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.